Welcome to the Parish the Thought Show. The opinions of Brian, your host, and his guests have not been sanitized or scientifically tested, so please consume at your own risk. Now, here's Brian.
Ladies and gentlemen, and whoever else is listening, welcome back to the show. My guest today is Mallory Roush, author of the book Inspired to Recover and owner of Roush Recovery. She has deep knowledge of the ups and downs of addiction and recovery, as she is a recovering addict herself of almost 10 years. We deep dive into the choices and paths she traveled, and we get to meet an angel who truly saw her and probably saved her life. Mallory, thank you for joining me today on the Parish the Podcast show.
So glad to be here. Finally, we made it happen.
We kept standing each other up, and now here we are. So I'm just going to let you tell your story your way. No prompts. Where do you want to go? How's that? No pressure?
Yeah, let's go. Hey, so my career, what I do now, I'm a motivational speaker. I go travel to high schools, rehabs, prisons, sharing my story. This is not a career I chose. This career definitely chose me. As a child, I felt like all of us get to a place where we are wondering, you know, what is our purpose? What are we doing here? And we spend so much of our life trying to find that. I luckily was able to identify by taking everything I had been through and applying it to what skills do I have now and what am I passionate about and how can I help others not make the same mistakes I've made. In my story, that looks like addiction, but it changes for every circumstance. Everyone's story is so different, but so powerful. So as a child, I grew up with a single mom and a father that was not involved at all. I was the youngest of five girls, but three of my sisters I still haven't met. My closest sister is 10 years older than me with a different father. So I felt like most of my childhood, I was growing up, you know, an only child, which really developed me and my mom's relationship. My mom's always been my very best friend, and we protected each other because we were, you know, really all each other had. Although I was young, my mom was struggling with alcoholism. And as a child, we don't fully have the maturity to understand, you know, why things happen or why people's behaviors are the way they are. But her addiction and the demons that she was battling were affecting me, because it starts putting these thoughts in our head of, you know, am I the problem? Am I what makes my mom sad? Or, you know, what is my parent struggling with? And you just want to, you know, when you're there
just for a minute.
Yeah.
On that, because this is a common theme I've heard with kids who are either being abused or around situations like your parents. Why do you think a child, and how old were you at this time?
So this was from four to, about 10.
Why do you think a kid, an innocent child, puts that burden on themselves, like they've caused it or it's their fault? Why do you think that is?
So children, their brains when they're young are trying to develop, right? They're acquiring skills and understanding and systems, thinking patterns, processes. And as a child, I think that there's, you know, a naive sense of love, right? A child hasn't been damaged. They haven't gone through trauma like us older adults have. When an adult is projecting negativity, self-talk, behavior, it's easy for a child to look at someone they trust, right? Someone they love, especially if it's a parent or family member, and believe the things that they're hearing and they're saying. We're teaching our children how to look at themselves, how to view themselves, how to talk to themselves, as well as the child, you know, their parent most of the time is the role model. So when a child sees a mother talking down to herself or being very negative, they will most likely follow in that pattern. It's called generational repetition. As my mom was battling her demons, I was, you know, trying to find my self-worth. And luckily, that was in school for me. I loved school. I was a straight-A student. I joined every group that I could, cheer, yearbook, student council, National Honor Society. I realized as I got a little older into more middle school that my intentions of being a good student weren't genuine intention. The intention was I was using these grades to create a self-value, right? If I'm a straight A student, I'm not a failure, or no one's going to see what I see myself as if I cover it up with all these distractions. And also it kind of took me away from home. You know, if I was in an activity after school, then I didn't have to go home and face, you know, the pain and the worry and the instability that I was facing. So I get into a program called the National Honor Society, which they placed me in the college so that I could graduate early. So my college credits applied for double high school credits. That was probably one of the worst decisions that I ever made. With the lack of self-esteem, lack of confidence, lack of self-value that I had already, being thrown into a college atmosphere with kids who are chaotic, disruptive, coping, it put me in an environment where I was with older, broken people and was only becoming more broken. So I started, you know, finding these friends that handed me weed one time, and that weed turned into drinking every weekend, and every weekend of beer and marijuana turned into constantly using a substance to fulfill whatever the void was that I was filling. And then hanging out around people who justified it, right? Who didn't tell me I was screwing up, who didn't make me feel bad for my bad choices, right? We all did it together. So misery loves company. One night at a party, I ended up meeting a guy that I fell for pretty hard. You know, I think in this time, I was about 13, and I started really feeling, you know, for what I knew it to be, love. I realized that I was craving this connection. Human beings, we're here because we're made to connect. And that's the most fulfilling thing there is in this life, is full, genuine, intimate connection. And I meet this boy, and I, like a little young teenager, fall in love, right? Well, he was older. He was part of that college group. And one night I had a really bad headache. I had been drinking a lot of beer and smoking a lot of marijuana. And I said, my head is pounding. And he pulls a little blue pill out of his pocket, and he says, take this, it'll make you feel better. And in that moment, everything around me went in slow motion. I was deep in my head thinking about, if I don't accept this, he will not love me, right? We start becoming and conforming however we have to, because we're so desperate to feel like we're enough, like we're going to fit in, that we're loved and wanted. So I take the pill, and within 30 minutes, it hits me. Come to find out, the pill was oxycodone, a 30 milligram oxycodone. For those of you who don't know what that is, it's a pain narcotic. And I realized that that one pill numbed my trauma, right? My internal battles. It quieted the voices inside of my head to the way more than the marijuana and the beer ever did. So quite frankly, I started into the pill addiction, and we got very deep. Within about 6 months, my boyfriend and I were moved into his father's house, you know, living in a dark room together, smoking pills. And my boyfriend got one of his friends had medical papers that were falsified. So within another couple months, we ended up with 5 prescriptions, 300 pills apiece each month from 5 different doctors. Then all of a sudden, which, you know, in an addict's mind, that's money, right? All you see is the dollar bills. But really what really happens is we get high on our own supply, because an addict is an addict and will always, you know, act as an addict. So then the opiate pandemic hit, and all of our prescriptions, the day we were going to fill them, were canceled. So because we were so dependent on the oxycodone, we had 12 hours from our last use until we were going to withdraw. And it's a very, very, very painful process. It's 3 days. And yeah, you can't sleep. You shake. You can't go to the bathroom. It's terrible. So we're panicking, right? We're calling all over town. We're trying to find anyone who can give us what we need before we withdraw. Obviously, everyone was holding on to them because they were scared as well. And my boyfriend's brother comes up to us and says, "Hey, I have something that can fix this. Take this," right? Once again. And
it's bigger and better leveling up of medication.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is when our heroin addiction began. See, what I've noticed through every drug journey I've gone through is that each drug for each individual attains a different goal, right? So with the oxycodone, it's the numbing, the downer. So heroin and oxycodone would be very, very similar. Same thing. It numbs all of you, not just the battles. I am such a happy, bubbly human being most of the time. And it took all of that away. It took my smile away. It took my care for anything away. And even though I was so numb, I realized that in my head. I was like, I hate who this has made me. And so to counteract how low I was, I then started using methamphetamine. Now this drug, the goal it was fulfilling for me was that it gave me my personality back, right? It gave me this false sense of I can do anything, and you had no idea of time. So one time when I was really bad in my addiction, I sat in a car and with a little 8-compartment screw box, and I organized this little screw box for like 9.5 hours. Didn't even realize, you know, how much time had gone by. So then I start dropping a lot of weight, and I get down to pretty low, about 70 pounds. And
that's crazy.
I end up going.
For context, what do you weigh normally?
So I'm 4'11", and I weigh about, my average weight's about 130.
So you're almost half.
Yeah.
That's, wow.
Yeah, it was definitely crazy. You don't eat at all, which in my head, I still look normal. I was hot. I was like, I'm skinny. You know what I mean? Yeah. But I've been a gymnast most of my life. So I am more of a stocky build, and I do have a lot of strength. And so I showed up one Easter to an Easter party my family was having, and my mom was like, whoa, she hadn't seen me in, you know, 6 months. We isolate when we don't want people to know what we're doing. And that was definitely how I treated my family. She saw me for the first time in a while, and she was like, holy crap, what is wrong with you? And I'm like, Mom, I'm just on the Slim Fast diet. We joke about that all the time. I think that's when she really started realizing that something was really wrong. You know, I had mastered the skill of manipulation. So I always used excuses like, you know, I can't come see you because I'm at a church activity, or I'm volunteering at the college, or I'm, you know, always an excuse to make me sound good. Well, in this time when my addiction started getting really bad, my mom has, we kind of joke about it being a 5-year thing. So she would use for 5 and then be clean for 5 and then use for every 5 years she would relapse. And so she was clean at this time. And we had switched places. So my boyfriend and I start getting in really deep to the meth and heroin thing. We start making trips to Vegas to sell and distribute. It lasts about 2.5 months, and I start getting scared. One of our dealers told me, Mal, I don't know what it is, but you shouldn't be in this. He's like, you're one of the, you know, nicest people I've ever met. How did you get so deep into this, right? And he goes, I just think you need to get out now. So I sat on that thought for a minute, and I wanted to get out so bad. I didn't love my boyfriend anymore. I hated myself. I missed my family. But I kind of started feeling like I was too far in. I was too deep. There's too much wreckage. Which I think is a very common mentality for a lot of people, whether they're in addiction or not, is, you know, we get overwhelmed by the amount of mistakes that we've made, that the thought of trying to repair them, or where to even start repairing them, it's just too much. And so we never take that first step to really start the healing process by facing things forward. We just keep shoving them down. And so I decide one day, I go, I'm done. I'm going to quit. And I tell my boyfriend I'm going to quit. And he goes, you're stupid. You're going to withdraw. And I was like, I know. And he's like, well, I'm not quitting. So I laid down that night. The 12 hours creeped up on me. And for the next 3 days, I went through the excruciating pain of withdrawal. On the third day, it was Mother's Day of 2013. And I remember waking up that morning, Ryan, and the window was cracked. And I could feel the warmth of the sun on my skin, which is something I hadn't felt in so long. And I could smell my boyfriend's dad cutting grass. And it was just like I was alive again. I grab the phone and I call my mom and I'm bawling my eyes out. And I go, Mom, happy Mother's Day. I want to see you. I go, I'm clean. I told her, you know, everything we had been going through. And I just told her I wanted to come home. And so her and my sister and I, we all went to breakfast and had a beautiful time, connected once again. And my sister followed me over to my boyfriend's house to help me pack all my stuff. And the second that my car hit the parking lot, St. George SWAT hits my house. Officers everywhere, cop cars everywhere. One cop pulls open my door, grabs me out, throws me to the floor, cuffs me behind my back and throws me up against a tree. And just like before, everything around me for this moment slows down. And I realize that just because I was making a different choice today doesn't mean there wasn't a price to pay for the choices I had already made, right? That wreckage. And I don't think you really realize it until you're in a situation like this of, oh, I kept screaming, I'm clean, I'm clean, I'm changing, I'm moving out. But that doesn't matter, right? Because the cops have been watching me for the last 3 months. In my report way later on, I even read that they got a garbage truck and they lined it with, you know, sanitary, I don't know, cloth or whatever. And so they only came and got our trash can so that everything within the truck could be used as evidence because it wasn't mixed with anyone else's, right? So there was no way we could.
At this point, because when we started, you were 13. How old are you at this point in the story?
Yeah, so now I am about 16 and a half.
You're a professional now.
Yeah, not yet, but we're getting there.
Okay.
Yeah, so I definitely get arrested. They raid our house. Me and my boyfriend both go to jail. And I call my mom and I'm crying my eyes out. And I'm like, Mom, please bail me out. Like, you know what we were about to do. And she was like, yeah, absolutely, I'll come get you. So I did. She made me do about a week in there to learn my lesson. And it was one of the hardest weeks of my life. You know, a lot of people say maybe jail doesn't scare them. But for me, it was terrifying. It was definitely mentally difficult to realize that you were locked up, you know, that your life was going on without you. So my mom bails me out and she drives me personally to my boyfriend's father's house where we were staying that just got raided so that we can get my stuff and go home. Well, as I walk in the room, my mom's out talking to my boyfriend's dad on the porch, and I open the door and I realize that there's a little container on the middle of the floor. And I know exactly what it is because it's where we had kept our heroin. And I look around because the room is trashed. And I'm sitting here and I can't help but think, how would St. George SWAT miss evidence? And so I walk into the room and I go to pick it up and I realize that our meth bottle full of meth is still sitting by the foot of the bed. And I'm just completely confused how all these drugs were not taken into evidence. So I don't have much time to think about it. My mom's like, hurry up. So I throw all my clothes and stuff in boxes. I take the heroin and the meth and the phone. I end up finding my boyfriend's phone and I put that in the box too. And we go home that night. I end up grabbing the heroin and I drop it in the toilet because I'm like, I'm never going through that painful withdrawal again. But that was easy because it wasn't my DOC. My drug of choice was the methamphetamine. So I tell myself that I'm going to sell this meth and I'm going to make money to get back up on my feet, right? So I keep it. And the longer I'm holding this drug, you know, over the next couple minutes, we start our addictive behavior starts coming out, and I start making every excuse as to why I can just have one use, just one time. I can just have a little bit and I'll sell the rest. So what do? I take a hit and my meth addiction begins to spiral. The next 4 months were the peak of my addiction. I was hanging out with people who were using intravenously, which I always said I would never do that. I would never use needles. I was the kid that would go to get their kids their school shots and 10 doctors howl me down. So yeah, there was no way in my mind that would ever happen. Obviously, as addicts, when we're in active addiction, we do things that we normally would never do. And I was hanging out with dealers, and one night I start falling asleep, and I had been up for a few days and I was in the Motel 6, and I fall asleep, and within a few minutes wake up to my heart racing out of my chest. The peak of adrenaline I've never, ever felt in my life. And I look over to my left and the dealer is pulling a needle from my arm. And that is when life really changed for me. I was no longer just addicted to the drug. I was addicted to the needle. And that was a crazy concept to me. I was like, how can someone be more addicted to the needle? But it's a thing psychologically. You're connected completely. So I start using intravenously.
You were going to sleep and he shot you up without you.
Yep. Just because that was the only way he used. So he thought it would be funny, right?
To shoot you up.
Mm-hmm. It's like that excitement of wanting to experience something with someone for the first time. Same concept. So once you use intravenously, I don't care who you are, you're hooked.
Can we talk about just, because my mind wants, I want to go down all the dark holes.
Yes, I love it.
What?
I get sick of hearing my own voice.
Yeah, because let's call the evil and the ugly what it is through your veins. I mean, is that, and how fast before that feeling or whatever the drug's supposed to do hits you when you shoot through your veins? Seconds?
The whole syringe is even in.
I guess, yeah. I've had shots and, you know, on surgeries and see them, but.
Okay. Have you ever been to BioLife?
Oh, like
donating, the plasma blood services? Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you do that and you go through your, you know, whatever, your process, and they put the saline in you, you know that feeling where your whole body gets like really cold all of a sudden?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, imagine that, but it's warm and warm as like long.
It's like a, I don't know, like a mix between morphine and like when your leg goes numb and you feel all those needles in your leg, it's just a big wave of warmth needles that sends you into a cloud of euphoria. And it's, you know, very, yeah, it's crazy.
Explain euphoria, as we hear the word, but can you explain, I mean, what does that look like or feel like?
It's like a deep sense of dream. Like, have you ever held your breath for so long that you're about to pass out? It's kind of like that. Like when I was young, there were things that people used to do that were called whippets, where they would inhale the cream bottle, right? Or huff on a balloon until you passed out. It's very similar to that. In the short few seconds of you passing out, you're in this almost like a hallucination, this dream, this feeling and place of perfection. Yeah, it affects your system. So through medical terms, like women can orgasm through it. That's how intense it is.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's not, you can't go back to smoking something when you feel that. And so, yeah, unfortunately, I got very, very hooked on that feeling. And I ended up getting arrested again, thank God. So this dealer that I was hanging out with promised that he would get me high as I wanted, as long as I hung out with him, right? I'm like, okay, perfect. So we go through a few weeks of using, and one day he asks me if I want to go somewhere, and I say yeah. So we get in this big van. You know those big vans that like say free candy on the back? They were like the rapist van, right?
Yeah, the creeper vans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he had one of those with no windows on the side.
Of course.
Yeah.
Why would you be driving a Toyota Corolla? No.
Yeah. Yeah. So I get in and we start driving, and he explains to me that he owns an asphalt business. And that also the back of the van, when I look back, was just all tools, like just looked like a handyman van, right? Which meant nothing to me. So we use all night, we stay awake for a while, and I start falling asleep in the passenger seat again. I'm like, I just can't stay awake. And we had ran out of meth. So I fall asleep. He pulls to the side of the road on the Bloomington Golf Course in here in St. George. And he apparently gets out to go site for gas. When he goes to site for gas, I end up waking up to a cop with a flashlight banging on my on the passenger side window. He opens the door and needles fall out onto the floor. Instantly, I get arrested and they set me on the grass. And they open the van and I hear a cop say, "Found him." And I was like, "Found what?" And the cop ends up letting me know that every single tool in the back of the van had been stolen from local businesses, and that I was going to be charged a felony for every single item in the back of the vehicle. And I was like, "Fingerprint them. I didn't do this. Like, I can't even lift half of those things." But obviously, you know, that's when I learned a really valuable lesson. You are who you hang out with. So as I can say that, you know, wrong time, wrong place, wrong time, abso-freaking-lutely. And even though I may not have committed the crime, I was hanging around people who obviously were, which makes me just as guilty, right? If you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And so they ended up taking me into interrogation. I sat there asleep with my head down and my arms cuffed around a chair for about 12 hours. And finally end up waking up, and the interrogator, a lady, comes in, a lieutenant. And she goes, "Why are you doing this, Mallory?" And I was like, "Doing what? I didn't do any of this." She's like, "Why are you using?" And you could tell she was a mom because she was trying to connect with me, you know, in a loving way. I asked her where the guy was that was driving the van, and she said that he had been taken into custody and we were both going to be charged with all those. So it was 15 felonies and 14 misdemeanors. And I asked her if I can go to the bathroom, and I get in the bathroom and I look in the mirror as I pull my sleeves up, and I just have black track marks, like someone took a Sharpie all over my arms. And I just hated everything I was, everything that I had done. It just felt like, you know, this was it. Like, this was the end. Like, I'm never going to get to live a normal life again. So they end up taking me to jail. I do about 3.5 months. I end up getting out, going into drug court program. I failed. I go back to jail. I get into inpatient treatment. They turn me loose. Come to find out later on, my funding had been canceled. So the rehab told me that it was due to me breaking rules. Yeah, that wasn't the case. The money stopped coming in. And so they released me without even calling a sponsor or family or anything. And what would an addict do that's freaking sick of this crap? Like, I already know I'm a failure. I already know I'm a piece of crap. I already know I have no value. I already feel like a mistake. How about you guys start pointing out the things that I don't already know? So I end up leaving that rehab, or leaving the inpatient rehab, and going straight to my dealer's house. The rehab lets me know that my sentencing date will be in about a month. So for the next month, I use as much as I can. And November creeps up. And I'm sitting in the parking lot and I decide, hey, if I'm going away for potentially almost 30 years, what would one last use hurt? So I take the biggest syringe that I can create. And I shoot myself up right before I walk into the courthouse. And I'm standing there in court. They call my name. I stand up to the podium. And I start thinking of all the things that I'm never going to get to experience. Being a mom, falling in love, traveling the world, right? Everything that I remember the little girl in me, or when I was a little girl, all the things I dreamed of most. All of a sudden, the court doors behind me slam open. This guy comes running in. He's like, "Judge, I need to talk to you." So he goes up to the judge and they talk for what seems like forever. And the judge looks at me and says, "Mallory, I don't know what Chuck can do for you, but I'm going to give him the chance. I'm going to put you on a 3-year zero tolerance probation." He's like, "If you mess up, you're out of here." I'm like, "Okay." And that day they released me. So I run out to that guy. I'm like, "Who is this guy, right? What's going on?" I run out to this guy and I go, "Hi, my name is..." He's like, yeah, I know who you are. I'm like, "Okay." He's like, "I'll see you in 2 weeks." And he gives me a paper with his address of his office on it. Well, would you believe me if I told you that I screwed up again? A miracle happened.
Patterns.
I get let
see
go.
Some patterns.
You know, I've had people who have read my book. Luckily, it's making a big difference. And I'm so grateful for that, which we'll talk about in a minute. But they say, you know, Mal, the one thing I realized when, you know, reading your book, that addiction just seems like a prolonged cycle. And I was like, "You're right. It's on and off and on and off and on." And that's every story, right? Every story is pretty much the same, except for the people, place, change the name of the people, places, and things. Everything develops the same way. So I end up going that night and stealing my mom's car, driving to Vegas with 3 friends, causing chaos in our lives, using, driving, stealing. And we're there for about 24 hours. We start driving back and I bust the right side mirror off my mom's car. And as we are pulling into St. George, my phone rings and I go, "Hello." And he goes, "Hey, Mallory, it's Chuck." And I go, "Hi, Chuck, what's up?" He goes, "I need you to come into my office right now." I was like, "Oh, you said 2 weeks." And he was like, "Nope, I need you to come in right now." I'm like, "Great." So I drop all the people off and I go to his office and I'm very obviously messed up, you know, sleep deprivated. I go into his office and I know that I'm screwed. This is it. I had a zero tolerance. So I sit down in front of his desk and he goes, "Well, Mallory, it was good knowing you." He grabs a paper off his fax and he lays it on the desk and he goes to sign it. And I just jolt and I go, "Please don't send that in." And he looks at me and doesn't say a word. And I was like, "I want to be clean. I know I can do this. Please." I start bawling. I'm like, "Please, please, please. I don't want to go to prison." And he goes, "Mallory, what the hell do I have to do to get you to choose to live?" And he goes, "Why the hell do you not think all of those programs haven't worked for you? Are you just defiant? Is that the problem here?" And I sat there for a minute crying and I vulnerably said, "I just want to be inspired into recovery, not punished." Every program I had been to was about punishing, time out, isolation, telling me what I'm doing wrong. I already know what I'm doing wrong. I'm good at that. I need to know what I do right. I need to know the value I have that I haven't identified that I can provide. I want to know what my purpose is and help and support in fulfilling that. So Chuck looks at me for a minute and he takes the paper in front of him and he rips it in half and he throws it in the garbage and he said, "I won't send it into the court." He said, "But you're going to listen to me from here on out." And by him doing that, I think I had a moment where I realized that he believes in me, which is something I hadn't seen in any of the therapists I had dealt with up until this point. And so he goes, "Mal, every day for the next 6 months, you're going to leave a 1-minute voicemail on my phone if I don't answer, but you're going to call me every single day. If I do answer, we'll have a conversation. This is going to tell me 2 things. 1, if you're high, and 2, how your mentality is progressing." So for the next 6 months, I call him every single day. On days that he answered, we had really good conversations. And, it felt like I was talking to a father figure. And then on days he didn't answer, I just left a 1-minute voicemail. And he, in that 6 months, wasn't really doing anything. He was just there. He was answering more of my calls than he wasn't. And those conversations started becoming so valuable because, you know, he was encouraging my dreams. He was loving me until I was strong enough to love myself. And all he ever said to me was what he saw in me, what he loved about me.
from, you know, the value I had to offer. And he started building this self-value from the outside in. So when the 6 months get to an end, I call Chuck and I go, hello, Chuck. And he's like, hey, Mal, what's up? And I was like, just calling you to do my 1 minute check-in. And he goes, Mal, your 6 month check-ins ended yesterday. He goes, you don't have to call me anymore. And I was like, very sad about that because I wanted to talk to him. I looked forward to our phone calls at this point. You know, I was seeing the happiness come out of me again. And I was scared that without the phone calls, that was going to end. So he said, Mal, you got this. It was like, you have to love yourself. I loved you until you were strong enough, but you're strong enough to love yourself now. And he goes, and it's time for you to start living. So I end up going and applying for school. And I really wanted to be in the medical field because I thought it's where I could help the most people. But I realized that's the only degree that has a background check. And I was so bummed out. So I call Chuck and I go, Chuck, I really wanted to get into the healthcare admin program, but there's a background check and I'm not going to ever pass that. And he goes, Mal, how bad do you want it? And I was like, bad. And he's like, then go for it. And I was like, do you hear yourself? I'm not going to pass that. And he's like, Mal, if you want it bad enough, you'll figure it out. So that day, and the background check wasn't until the very end of the degree, which was weird. But so I signed up for the degree and I went for it. I started living. I got an amazing job with a company here, a little cafe here in town that became like my second family. And then I was, you know, supported me through all of the things I was doing. And most of them were recovering addicts, which was awesome. You know, we could all relate in recovery. Started, you know, making friends with people who were going to meetings and being successful in life. I started developing a relationship with a man who now is my husband. And I just started loving life. So 2.5 years goes by and my boyfriend then, husband now, but Wes and I were sitting on the couch one night. We were roommates. We were sitting on the couch one night. We were playing Xbox and eating pizza and we get this ring on the doorbell about 9 p.m. And I open the door and there's two pieces of paper laying on the mat. I pick them up and shut the door and I open them and the first paper is a successful congratulatory completion of probation. Chuck was terminating me. And I opened up the second paper, and the second paper was a full 402 clearance of my entire record. Every felony, every misdemeanor wiped clean.
And I didn't know that was a thing. I didn't know that they could do that.
Yeah, I didn't either. So I fell to my knees because that was really the only thing I still had that in my head was holding me back was that my past was going to follow me and I was never going to be able to get a home if I was a felon. I was never going to be able to get a good job and be trusted, you know, on a professional level. And that sucked that, you know, forever is a long time for something like that to follow you. And so this man gave me back everything and more. He changed my life by loving me. And he always used to say, Mal, love is the antidote, right? Love is the antidote. He always used to also tell me that we can't control the things that we go through, but we're responsible for the healing from them. I really think that I listened to him when it came to growing because I felt like he believed in me instead of that I was a lost cause, that there was too much wreckage. He walked me through fixing and repairing that wreckage every step of the way. So then my boyfriend at the time proposes, and that brings up a lot of traumatic feelings. I'm like, I don't have a dad to walk me down the aisle. I can't get married. And Wes goes, Mal, why don't you have Beth walk me down the aisle? So I start calling Chuck, and I get his voicemail, and I go, hey, Chuck, it's Mal. I just want to talk to you about something important. Give me a call back. I didn't want to tell him on the voicemail that I was going to ask him to walk me down the aisle because I wanted to hear his reaction. And 3.5 months goes by and I don't hear a word.
I start wondering if, because I had graduated, it was a conflict of interest. So I kind of just gave up and I asked my grandpa to walk me down the aisle. The day before my wedding, I get a call from Chuck's very best friend telling me that Chuck has been fighting pancreatic cancer and he's being put on hospice and he's asking for me. So I drop my phone. I literally sprint to the car and I drive to his house as fast as I can. Go up to the front door and his wife opens the door and there's like 100 people there, but it's like the most silent room you would ever, I've ever heard. His wife takes me by the hand and takes me to his room, and second the door opens, he had lost like 100 pounds and he was pale. And I sat there on his bed and his wife and I just really got to share a moment of love. And we had only met a couple times really before, but we understood each other's connection. And she said, not a lot of people have been over to see him. He hasn't wanted anyone to see him, but he asked for you. And so I put my hand on his hand and I can feel where the nurses are pulling the IVs out and the tape. And I just start bawling. I don't know what to say in a moment like that. And he looks at me and he goes, "Hey, Mel." And I go, "Hey, Chuck." He said, "Sorry, I haven't been answering your calls." And I go, "Yeah, it's okay. I guess you've been busy." And he says, "Mel, I need you to do me a favor, or I need you to make me a promise." And I go, "What is that?" He goes, "I need you to promise me that you're going to tell our story." I start crying and I'm like, I promise. He says, "You were never a lost cause. And I'm so thankful for everything that we've gotten to experience. And I hope you can help others the way that I tried to help you." So I told him I promise, and I left the room that day knowing that was going to be the last time I was ever going to talk to my hero. He ended up passing away. I went from the worst day of my life to the best day of my life within 24 hours. And being at the wedding was a moment of, I had everything thanks to him. And to not be sharing that moment with him was very difficult. Knowing that he was in pain while I was celebrating didn't seem like a fair trade-off. So he died 4 days later. It took me a year and a half to figure out how I was going to fulfill that promise. So I grabbed a notebook and I started writing down everything that I could remember about him. Every lesson he had taught me, every quote he had said, every joke he had ever made, everything I hated. And I realized pretty quickly that I filled up the book and I looked at my husband and I go, "Wes, I'm going to write a book and use every lesson and information and knowledge and education that I can to not only, you know, connect through people's heart through my story, but also teach them all the things that took me so many years to learn." You know, when you're doing something you're meant to do, how everything just kind of falls in place. So happened when I was working as an assistant with a real estate agent back then, that real estate agent said, "Hey, I know a publisher. Here's their number." I was like, I would never write a book, right? Yeah, I ended up calling that publisher, and his name is Dave Smith. He's absolutely amazing. He read my first 6 chapters and called me and said, "Mel, we need to get your story out there." Like, he's like, I'm very inspired. And I think you're going to help a lot of people. So he started doing the breakdown with me on how much it was going to cost, which at the time I was just a server at a little mom and pop cafe. But I was like, there is no way I'm going to be able to pay $14,000. Dave pulls out his checkbook and says, "I will." And he pays for everything, all of the publishing, as well as lets me free write my chapters the way I want them, you know, and then helps me format them, works with me through every single chapter to make sure that it has as much power and as much education as possible. So I'm so thankful for him for that. And so, yeah, now today I go travel and I speak to high schools and rehabs and just try to really make a difference. I just patented an event for Utah called the Healing Utah Success Summit. Al Richards is my partner. We have been able to found this to give others a chance to tell their story. We, you know, we love telling our story, but we want to help coach others to be able to use their story on stage and impact as many people as they can, then every story is important. So the Healing Success Summit, we will be able to put in a state. So if we travel to like Nevada, we can put the Healing Nevada Success Summit. So yeah, we're on our fourth year. That is this year. We are going to be having it in Salt Lake, October 5th. For any of you listening, please add the Healing Utah Success Summit on Facebook. We will do updates whenever we do have that seminar going on.
Okay, backing up, how did Chuck enter your world? You said he just popped into the courtroom. How did he know about you? Wanted to have you on my show, because you were on my friend Heidi's Lemonade Stand.
Yeah.
Years ago. And your story about Chuck is what I'd never cried listening to podcasts before until I heard that one. And I'm doing it again now. Thank you very much. That was powerful. So how did he come into your world? This angel of a man.
That is literally the number one question I get every time I do a podcast and share my story. I don't know. So he literally, I don't know if he had been following my story. I'm not sure. I don't even know why he chose me. I don't know how he knew about me. When he ended up dying, his family made a Facebook page, and all the people he had helped went on there and kind of told a little bit of how they know Chuck. And mine kind of seemed silly. Like he just barged into my courtroom. You know what I mean? But as I read through people's stories, it's crazy, because quite often that was how their story began with him too. There was quite a few of them that said, I don't know how he was there at that moment for that reason. So I don't know if he was very, very involved. He used to be a cop, I believe, and then he was a probation officer in California. He's done huge drug busts. He was a man of go-getting power, which I never even ever heard about. So yeah, I don't know if he had a system where he was looking at maybe some of the worst cases in this area, which mine was all over KSL. So, I mean, everyone knew about my...
So you were doing it well. You're doing it good.
Oh yeah, you can type in. Yeah, it still shows up. You can still go look at it all. But yeah, there's news things all over it. And people are like, Mel, don't you want those to be taken down? I go, no, man, I looked like a badass. Now I'm even more of a badass, because now I get to teach people, you know, it's my credibility. I need people to see how bad it was. So they can see how gonna be.
Yeah, you're a badass and you want to teach people not to be the badass that you were.
Yeah, or a better badass in recovery and some healthy. Yeah.
So this statement that I've often heard, that, you know, once an addict, always an addict. Is that true? It seems like that's my gut is like, I hate that, because it's like, well, no, they overcome it. They're not anymore. Or so, alcoholic. Maybe it's just with alcoholics. I don't know.
Yeah. So in the beginning of my career, you know, I used to answer this question with what I thought the recovery world here in St. George, Utah wanted me to answer it with. And to be quite honest, I'm done doing that.
What was the answer you thought they wanted to hear versus
the answer? The answer that they want to hear is that once an addict, always an addict.
That seems like it's job security for the...
Yeah, people that aren't even working right for like NA, which, don't get me wrong, love NA. They have done so much for my life. I'm so thankful for the amount of years I went to meetings. I stopped going to meetings because cliques started forming. People were being shunned for a lack of time, or, you know, they were not supporting people who had just relapsed. Like, you're not good enough. And became very negative. And they were teaching that, or the group, and this was many years ago, but the group was teaching that, you know, once an addict, always an addict. We have to constantly remind ourselves of our rock bottom, right? So that we don't allow ourselves to slip again. But what was happening to me and my mentality, and this is the answer that I'm no longer scared to say out loud, because I'm paving a new path of recovery completely. But it's that if you are a smoker, Brian, and you quit smoking, and people come and ask you if you're a smoker, are you going to say you're a smoker?
Yeah.
And you don't? No. Right? So why would it make any sense to say you're an addict? Now, when I refer to myself, I think I'm always going to be in recovery. Once you start recovery, life is a journey of recovery, whether that be healing from trauma, whether that be, you know, growing from childhood abuse, whether that be, you know, addiction. I think life will always be a recovery process, and we're all in recovery. Every freaking person is in recovery from something somehow, because we're all wanting to evolve and grow and be our best selves. Every one of us has childhood trauma that we should be recovering from. And if people aren't, then they just haven't identified it yet. They're still in the delusion of, you know, hiding it and pushing it down. But the truth is, recovery to me is more than just staying clean or sober. It's acquiring new thinking processes and behaviors that are cracking the boundaries of what society says we have to be or what we have to do. You know, I went through a really big battle in the early, well, not way early, but about 3 years in my recovery. I still struggled with this idea that during my wedding anniversary, I wanted to have a glass of wine with my husband at a romantic dinner, like a normal human being would, right? Like, that's normal. And yet I was terrified. I had been told that you take a sip, you're going to be putting a needle in your arm. And I lived by that because I was so scared. What I've learned, you know, 8 years later, is that we can't scare ourselves into change. We need to face things forward. And I am truly a believer that if you heal from your trauma and your boundary and your abuse, if you can get to a place of genuine healing, then for some, they can have a glass of wine on their wedding, or they can have champagne at a wedding toast. So I'm definitely one that believes that, you know, just because you've been an addict doesn't mean you can't live life on life's terms ever again. And to be honest, a lot of addicts who want to, you know, get clean and be in recovery, it's sad to feel and think like we are broken and we can never be like normal human beings again. That's a broken mentality, and it's never going to allow you to flourish. You know what I mean?
Well, it's like, this, you're trying to shed this dark past, this all this horribleness, but yet the system seems to encourage you to carry it with you for the rest of your life.
Exactly. It's not working. So that brings me to one more thing I wanted to tell you. I haven't told very many people about this. So this will be only for your podcast.
Dropping live today.
Ball drop, right. So I have published my book, Inspired to Recover. It's not just a bibliography, or it's not just a biography where I tell you what happened. I take you by the hand through every decision and help you understand the addict's perspective and teach the reader how to deal with underlying causes, how to identify those thinking processes early on so that they can be corrected, right? All this education, but you go through every decision I ever made with me. You're in the hurt, you're in the vulnerability, you're in the brokenness. And, you know, it was really hard because I had to find the fine line of, I want it to be real enough for the addict to be like, that's exactly how it is. But I had to make it, I had to be careful not to make it too graphic to where if someone hasn't been an addict and this is all new to them, that it scares them away. It's too heavy. And I have had a few addicts that have read it said it is a little heavy and it can be a little triggering. So warning on that. But for your podcast only, Brian, my next book is a 90-day step-by-step healing program, not just for addiction, from anything, right? Recovery is a journey. And we just get better as time goes on. So this is a step-by-step 90-day healing program that helps rebuild you, breaks you down. It changes mindset. You go all for service, finding direction, building support. Everything that has made me and the people that I coach and the families that I help now that I teach at my seminar all packed in to one program. And it will be, and it can be done online as well. So I'll be hopefully doing some YouTube videos so that people, you know, who don't want to read a book can just follow me in a short YouTube explanation, and then hopefully have some really cool testimonials and rewards and things for people who can finish the program with me personally. And each person who ends up trying to do the program, I'll be able to sit there and be there with them through every step of the way, like Chuck was for me.
That is very cool. Mic drop.
Bam. Changing the world.
Changing the world. Well, that's, yeah. Well, you're doing it. You're doing what he told you to do.
Yeah.
And maybe Chuck's like an angel, and maybe he's not really past. He's just doing it somewhere else. Maybe he's one of these people that will live forever. I don't know.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. The one thing I never got with Chuck was a picture of us together. You know, you don't think of those things when you're going through the heavy things we are dealing with. And so my husband, one year for Christmas, he took a picture of me and a picture of Chuck, and he took them to an artist, and the artist combined them. So now I have a big portrait on our in our living room that is of me and him. And that was one of the most meaningful gifts I've ever gotten. So I still see him all the time. My husband makes fun of me when I'll walk by, like, "Hey, Chuck." So it's just good to know that he's still here, and I know he would be proud of me. You know, I think in the beginning of this, I had this high expectation of myself of like the promise is never going to be fulfilled, you know, but I think I already have fulfilled it, but now I'm just going to keep going and do even more to really see what I can do. And my goal is to make my book a movie. So the next step, I'm going to be trying to pitch it to some producers.
Well, and ultimately, I guess the ideal situation would be that you share it enough that people don't have to go down these roads at all.
Exactly.
Unfortunately, I don't think that's just skepticism, but the world's just going to be full of, there's no shortage of work in your field, I guess.
Right. Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yep. It's an ongoing thing.
Yep. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that. So that's why I started speaking in high schools first, because when people are in rehab, they've already made their choices, right? That's why they're there. Same thing with prison. But what was different about going to high schools was my story started in middle school, high school. So the earlier I can teach them these lessons on a level that their brain can, you know, their mind can understand, that's what I'm doing right now. I just got asked to speak for 3rd to 5th grade. So imagine trying to tell what I just told you guys to a 3rd and 5th grade. And there's a way to do it where, you know, I'm not talking about my drug use, but I'm talking about the concepts that maybe they're not learning at home, you know, like helping people, being a good person, just those really important vital things that can really keep people out of addiction.
Wow. That's a little mind blowing that you're going that young.
Yeah, it's my first one. So it'll definitely be a big move for me. We'll see how it goes. But yeah, and I really just want to leave an impact on the world, you know, and I think all of us do.
Yeah, when you leave, you want it to matter. You want people to cry when you go.
Right.
Are you getting any feedback from what you're doing? Is it touching? Are you finding out that it's moving people, touching people, keeping people from going down these dark paths? I guess maybe you'll never know, but what kind?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot that I may never know about, but I cannot tell you the amount of emails and calls that I get. It's been humbling. I mean, I never would have thought that my story could be helping so many people, and people reaching out and saying, "Mal, like, please, you know, come help us, teach us, you know, finding value in what I have to offer," which was what we, you know, to bring a full circle as children. That's what we wonder, how we can be of service and of value. And so now I get to take my, you know, darkest experience and really emit light. And I really try not to take things for granted anymore. I try to be there to help others when I can, but not sacrificing myself and my happiness and my boundaries anymore. I've gotten to see love as the antidote in so many things. Right now, my nephew is living with me. He was kind of getting involved with some bad friends, and I said, "Come live with me." So he's been living with me for about 3 weeks now, and we got him a job. He's got his hair cut. He's been changing. And he's been going to the gym with me every morning. And yesterday he came up to me and he goes, "Mal, I think I'm going to sell my Xbox." And I go, "What? Why? You love that thing." And he goes, "Because I think it's keeping me from being a better version of myself." He's like, "I've changed so much in the last 3 weeks since I've been here. I just want you to know how much it means to me. And I know I haven't had money, and I have had to pay for new clothes and the haircut and things like that. But for me, it's an investment if they're doing their part and they're doing the work that is going to change their life." And so he has the chance to move to Hawaii here in 2 months. And I go, "Finish school and pay for half your ticket it, and I'm all for it. Go live life, crack the boundaries of what society has taught us we have to do, and that's work 40 hours a week and be, you know, spending the time that we want to spend with the people we love most at doing something we don't love doing. I think anything we don't love doing isn't worth doing. And if you want to move to Hawaii, go. He has nothing stopping him here. He's 20. So, yeah, I'm at a place now, Ryan, where I encourage all of the grayscale. There is no right or wrong anymore at all in my head. I think anything is possible. I think that nothing is too hard. I mean, I have faced my biggest fears in the last year and a half, and I'm just so proud of who I am today and where I'm going. And I just hope that I can just continuously grow and help others do the same.
Yep. I'm assuming you've been asked this as well. Would you trade all this, all the darkness you went through? Would you give it all back to have a different
life? Absolutely. Absolutely not. Nope. I would go through it over and over and over again, especially if I knew, you know, the outcome of it. And I still don't know the outcome of it. You know, I'm young. I mean, no offense, all of my speaker friends out there listening, the people that I work with. I mean, my very best friend, Al Richards, you know, we created the Healing Utah Success Summit, and it started off with just me having an idea and him and I having a conversation as strangers. Now we're a team of like 8. So it's crazy, but they're all older. I mean, David DeRocher, one of the most amazing speakers and people I know who built the Other Side Academy, changes lives all the time. He's changed a whole village of people. And Todd Sylvester, he started talking to schools, you know, that were young, and I look up to him so much. He's also on the back of my book. But all of them found their purpose a little later.
The old guys can flourish too.
Yes, yes, but that gives me so much hope that I just barely turned 30 a couple days ago. I got 25 years ahead of them. So they're smarter than me, but I got more time. See, more time here. So hopefully I'll be as good as all of them one day, or, you know, that I'm just so thankful that I have people that I get to learn from and watch every single day, because dang, did I get lucky on the friend levels.
Yes. Definitely. God was looking out for you to give you all those opportunities for sure. Or what universe or whatever you want to call them. So, all right. So tell me the name of the book again and your website. Give me all those details. I'll put them in the show notes anyway, but tell people, for those who can't read or don't want to read, they can just listen.
Okay. My book is called Inspired to Recover, an Addict's Journey Through Addiction and Healing. And the ebook is on Amazon. You can get that, I think, for like $9.99. And then my website is Ruch Recovery. So Ruch Recovery .com. There is where I will have all of the paperbacks you can order, as well as all of the details for the Healing Utah Success Summit, where you will be able to buy tickets again, that in Salt Lake this year, October 5th. So tickets should go on sale here in the next month or so. So be looking out for that.
Awesome. I normally read the books of authors who I have on, but I have not read yours. So I am looking forward to getting on the ball.
Yes, I'm excited to hear what you think.
Yeah, well, I think I know the story, but I want to hear the details and your what you were seeing. And so thank you so much for coming on. It's been awesome to finally connect. Anyway, thank you again, Mallory, for coming on and sharing this. I appreciate it, and we'll get this launched out and let the world hear more of it. My 12 listeners worldwide will be changed forever.
I can't wait. Well, it makes a big difference, Brian.
Thank you again for listening to The Parish the Thought Show. We know you have many podcast options and appreciate that you have chosen us. If you love what you hear, please give us a rating on whatever platform you find us. And don't forget to share, like, and subscribe. If you hate what you hear, only tell us. You're still here? Click on the next episode for more from The Parish the Thought Show.